Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, do Democrats have much to say to rural Americans? One of the tests for that question is in the 1st District here in Minnesota, the one that Democratic Congressman Tim Walz represented before he decided to run for governor. The district encompasses Rochester. It also includes 21 counties, many of them rural. Can a Democrat speak the language of today's rural America and rural America as a whole? Democratic strategist and former Wellstone staffer Jeff Blodgett recently suggested to MinnPost that in a statewide election, DFLers should focus on the cities because that's where the votes are. More on that in a minute. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. If you're a Democrat living in a rural part of your state, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, North or South Dakota, do you feel like national Democrats understand the issues that motivate you and care about having you in the party? Have Republicans done a better job of looking out for your interests? So I'd like to hear from you as a Democrat wherever you can hear the show this morning. And I know we cover a number of states, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, North or South Dakota. As a Democrat, do you feel like the national Democrats understand the issues that motivate you and that they really care about having you in the party any other time rather than just election time? Do you think Republicans also speak to the issues and the interests that motivate you as a voter and as a Democrat? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Talk to me about it on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Two guests for the conversation. Brian Baxt covers politics in the state capitol for NPR. He's been thinking about this issue. Welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here, Carrie.
Philip Chen is with us. He's an associate professor of political science at Beloit College, and he joins us today from Madison, Wisconsin. Philip, welcome. I didn't know that you were back in Wisconsin. Good to have you here.
I am back in Wisconsin, although I'm only an assistant professor. I haven't gotten tenure yet.
only a matter of time, I'm sure, but good to have you here. Thanks so much. Brian, you suggested when we were talking about this that the first district race is an interesting example of whether Democrats can win in rural areas. What is it about what's the dynamics of what's happening in that district that make you think so?
Well, it's a district that has been trending Republican for years in terms of the legislative complexion of the delegation down there. And Tim Walz, who's been the congressman down there, has kind of been a unique figure. He's been able to speak the language of greater Minnesota at the same time as he's working on getting in those regional centers and getting those folks to turn out. He's leaving. So that left Democrats
to run statewide.
To run statewide. Yeah. So that's left Democrats to find somebody who can fit that mold. And they think they found the right candidate in Dan Feehan, who has a military background, just like Tim Walz did, has a teaching background, just like Tim Walz did, and is trying to kind of keep the focus on bread and butter issues, as opposed to some of these social causes that sometimes cause Democrats problems in these places outside the Twin Cities.
When you say that Walz has been able to speak the language of greater Minnesota, do you think that language sounds different in greater Minnesota than it sounds in rural areas and, I don't know, in other upper Midwestern states?
Well, I mean, you have to be able to speak the farm economy. You have to be able to speak about gun ownership in a way that people don't feel like it's threatening to them and their heritage of hunting. And you have to be able to speak about just quality of life for people who do work in different kind of settings. They're not working for a lot of these Fortune 500 companies like they do in the Twin Cities. They're working for smaller operations, so they're concerned about stability. And so you have to kind of walk that line a little bit more than you would if, say, for instance, you were in the suburbs or in the cities.
Philip, I want to take a call for you here from sure. Alexander in Zumbrota. Hi, Alexander. What's your story on this?
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to focus on the three national issues that the Wall Street Democrats and National Democrats have ignored that has been a negative effect for us in the rural area and I think in the inner city or the suburban area. And that's healthcare. Healthcare costs out here in the country are so ridiculously high, you can't afford it. And people have actually dropped healthcare. Number two is manufacturing. Bernie Sanders was right. We can't continue to export our jobs. And look at it, that we got a Republican president actually putting up import tariffs to try to get manufacturing back into the United States.
What's the third?
Third is, I'm going to call it the Bush-Obama wars. Obama was going to bring the troops home. And it just got, this war has have continued to escalate. And that cost, that variable cost for this, these ongoing wars have taken money out of the rural area, tax dollars out of the rural area.
So, Alexander, if I might, I think you told us that you're a lifelong DFLer. You don't think the National Party speaks well on health care, manufacturing jobs, and wars. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Philip, what do you make of that?
Sure. I actually think that's a great point. The big thing I think is when we look at how the National Party is talking about healthcare, this is a fantastic point in that healthcare at the national level is talked about often in these broad terms about how the national government is going to do it, and there's less of those specifics about what it means for rural America, for greater Minnesota, for example. I think I've plugged it on this program, I think, Carrie, before. Kathy Kramer has a phenomenal book on rural consciousness, of course. And I think that what you see when you read through her book is this lack of perhaps understanding of how deeply tied healthcare is to the space of rural areas, or how deeply tied manufacturing is. You know, it's one thing to say if a job moves from if a factory moves from North Minneapolis to Eden Prairie, you know, that's not actually probably going to happen, but because we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs in the cities. But there's a easier amount of sort of transportation within a concentrated area that just doesn't happen in rural areas. And so healthcare and healthcare costs in rural areas are, that's a great example of one of these issues where the way we address it nationally needs to be, there needs to be a conversation about how it is differently affected by geography, by space, and by place.
You know, Brian, I thought our caller might talk about guns when he was going down the list of issues. And this is something that you brought to our attention about how Dan Feehan, who is, as we said, running in this district that Tim Walz occupied, he's been asked about how he speaks about guns, an issue that can play very differently in rural Minnesota and rural America than it does in cities. What, before we listen to it, what struck you about the way Feehan answered this question?
Well, you know, for the Democratic Party this year, you're hearing a lot about cutting access to guns, particularly the semi-automatic weapons. And for folks who are Second Amendment supporters, they see any intrusion on that as a deeper threat. And so Dan Feehan had to talk about it because he's trying to figure out a way where he can kind of tap into the anxiety over gun, having too many guns out there, or perhaps too many powerful guns out there, and but not offend those people out there who do own some of these guns. And his answer was quite interesting to me.
Let's listen to it.
My experience with firearms is one that's deeply personally informed. I've been on the receiving end of automatic gunfire. The worst possible feeling you could have in your life. You can't think, you can't move. I've lost former students to gun violence. I've lost friends to gun violence by suicide. That informs how I approach the issue, and I think there is so much more we can be doing in terms of common sense reforms related to firearms. And with that, I think I'm going to take a new approach here, because ultimately, at the end of the day, I think what Tim Walz was elected on is the idea that people could see that he was able to put his community above all other things. And that's the same approach that I'm going to take, and with this issue in particular.
Yeah, Philip, I don't think you can get more genuine than talking about your own experience on the battlefield. I hear what Brian is describing there. What'd you hear?
I think that's true. You hear him, what you hear Dan saying is, yes, I've had experience with this. And what we need to do is some type of middle ground. He doesn't use the language of gun restrictions, or he doesn't use a lot of the language that the National Party might use. But the interesting thing to me is that when you look at a lot of these the platforms, they're the underlying policy is actually fairly similar. It's about framing. It's about how the issue is talked about. And he does a great job of talking about it in his own personal experience. You see there's a sort of the flip side to that, which is sort of the Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania type of thing, where it's really a pro-Second Amendment platform, whereas here we're hearing about the experiences and the way that we need to have, the language of common sense gun reform. Angie Craig in the 2nd District has also talked in a similar way about common sense gun reform.
This is why I think this is – you just mentioned Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, and then we had the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Brian. And there's a lot of attention that follows a big win from these candidates. They're very different candidates. I mean, this is why this question about who you can be as a Democrat and how you have to talk about, your idea of politics and your values in your separate districts is really interesting. I don't know that we're seeing any kind of overall arc to this. Do you?
No, and I don't think you can deny that there's a lot of enthusiasm and passion on the Democratic base heading into this
across the board,
the midterm
right.
election. But some of the issues that they're focusing on, like this in New York, where abolish ICE
right.
took off, that's not a good message for someone like Dan Feehan to try to have to latch
or
on
Connor
to
Lamb,
or answer.
Right.
right. So, I mean, that's the double-edged sword is the passion of the hardcore base wants some of these things that might not be to the electoral advantage of someone in one of these rural districts who's trying to get elected as a Democrat and who's trying to appeal to people who don't see it that way.
Philip, do you see any comparison to what this identity issue that Democrats are going through to what happened with Republicans years ago as more conservative Tea Party members were getting elected, and then they had to manage the caucus, which took down a couple of speakers, didn't it?
Yeah, you're taking the sort of the thoughts right out of my head on this one. I think that you do see a lot of this, that the Tea Party movement, which fashioned itself as sort of outside of the party system, but really was largely made up and run through the Republican primary system, that was essentially what we're seeing from someone like Alexandria Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Ocasio-Cortez, yeah.
From the left. And so the Tea Party, absolutely, I think there's parts of this that play in. And what we're seeing, I think, when you saw with the Tea Party is it was run through the primary system. And it was that energy on the right, in the case of the Republican Party, that made the Republican coalition in Congress very difficult to govern. Yes, you're right. A number of speakers have simply struggled with how to manage a caucus that has very disparate ideas of what it means to be what it means to be the Republican Party in Congress.
Yeah.
I think
if I might just interject there, because Paul Ryan was in town yesterday.
Yep.
Brian, were you at that event?
I went to one of the events in Burnsville in the 2nd District.
Yeah. I'm thinking about what happened with immigration. As Philip describes this, here's Paul Ryan trying to herd these cats of different kind of Republican stripes. Democrats are going to have to deal with this, too, if these Democrats end up being successful.
Absolutely. But at the same token, they'll have the advantage of not having to have total control of government, I guess, advantage or disadvantage, where they'll be able to be responding to administration proposals. The Republicans in Congress, the difficulty they have now is they have the keys to everything.
Yeah,
and so
I guess
the public
right.
expects more results. And that's why when they don't get results, it brings more attention to it.
Philip, you were going to add. I interrupted you.
No. I think that's right. And Brian has a great point there that you do see this. You look back to 2008 and the 2 years that there was unified Democratic control, the choice, I think, on from the Democratic Party was to focus on an issue where they thought perhaps they could have some kind of unanimity. And they still ended up needing a 60-vote margin and needing reconciliation to get the ACA passed. And so on the Democratic side, you saw that coalition or them coalesce around an issue where they thought there might be a path forward. But again, that sort of opposition Congress that we saw for 6 years of Obama's presidency from Republicans, that's the role that Democrats would be playing, at least if they were to take either the House or the Senate. They can offer policies, but they are really responding, like Brian said, to what's going on from the White House, who and so in some sense, they don't need to be able to govern in this kind of same way that Paul Ryan ended up needing to do after President Trump's election.
Interesting political morsel here. Brian and I were talking about this off air at the Cook Political Report. They've just issued some new ratings and predictions for the House. And since we've been talking about this, I think this fits in. Cook Political Report now updating 10 House races, mostly in Democrats' direction. And they say the outlook, Democratic gain of 20 to 35 seats. I'll retweet this and then you can kind of dig into the numbers. If you've just tuned into the conversation, having a discussion about this discussion that Democrats are having about their identity as we see different Democrats with different stripes win in different districts. And then we look at what's going on in Minnesota and we see Democrats of different stripes running statewide. And how are they speaking to voters in rural areas as opposed to the way they speak to voters in cities? Threading the needle is not easy as a Democrat running statewide. Brian Baxt with us to talk about this. He covers politics in the state capitol for NPR and kind of mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago about individual districts, congressional districts, and talking about the first district as being a good example of this. And Philip Chen with us. He's an associate assistant professor. I keep wanting to promote you there, Philip. Assistant professor of political science at Beloit College and with us from Madison, Wisconsin. So I want to hear from you if you're a Democrat and you're living in a rural part of your state, whether that's Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, North or South Dakota. I want to know if you feel like the national Democrats understand the issues that are motivating you and that you care about as a voter, as a Democrat who feels, what, at one with your rural community. Have Republicans in some ways done a better job looking out for your interests? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Some good comments here on Twitter. Pat says, I vote Democrat. I'm from Stacy, Minnesota, 45 miles from St. Paul. Where's my high-speed internet? No transit at all. We're flyover country to flyover country. No transit. What's wrong with everyone in the cities? Dimitri says, I've lived in rural Minnesota and in Minneapolis. What's the mystery here? It's a basic fact. You trade off access to high-speed internet. Boy, that's a big issue. More businesses, variety of arts, entertainment, etc. for more space, cheaper land, and homes, less traffic. What are Democrats talking about this?
Absolutely. I mean, and both parties are actually talking about this internet issue. Broadband has been kind of one of the consensus points of a need. They've disagreed on the solution.
Okay.
But they've been trying to put more money. And then, you know, this transit versus roads thing has been, of course, one of the key wedge issues that Republicans have used against Democrats in greater Minnesota, saying you're supporting too many of these trains and bus lines in the cities.
This has been going on at the state capitol for decades, this argument.
It has, but it's been elevated. And any time the Republicans can bring something to a vote, they do, just to drive home the point. I want to one data point here, just to bring it back to the state capitol for a bit. It was in 2010 that Democrats had 87 seats in the state legislature to the Republicans 47. Fast forward to today, and it's 56 for the DFL. And where have most of those losses come? Outside the Twin Cities area. And so it's become a party that's power base has been concentrated a lot inside the Twin Cities. And I was glad you brought up the Jeff Blodgett thing, because that's a struggle that the party is going through right now is how to, you know, maintain the statewide success they've had. They've had great statewide success.
It's been 12 years since a Republican won statewide.
That's right. And But at the same time, they're forfeiting a lot of the territory out in greater Minnesota. So it's one of these puzzles that party leaders are having to work through. And one of the things they're trying to do is talk more about healthcare. They're going to be talking more about agriculture in the context of the trade tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to keep away from the things that have caused them loss of support in greater Minnesota.
Philip, if you look at the 2016 map, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, don't you find a pretty similar pattern to what Brian just described in Minnesota?
Yeah, I think Minnesota is actually a sort of a microcosm of what we see at the national level, which is that Democrats tend to what we call geographically cluster, that you're more likely to find Democrats in cities and in larger population centers and in a smaller geographic area. It's just sort of the nature of, you know, you can there's debates as to whether that's because of wanting to move to a place like that for access to things they value or whether it has to do with class or race. There's lots of different reasons that we might experience what we call geographic sorting along these lines.
Mm.
But what that means is it doesn't even have to be something as simple as gerrymandering, that there's simply not a way to divide up clustered Democrats in a way that is roughly that meets requirements of geographical compactness and all of the things that are required for redistricting. And so this is why when you look at a lot of the reports for the what we call the generic ballot, the Democratic generic ballot, part of it is incumbency, but the evidence suggests that the Democrats need roughly a 7% win on the sort of the generic ballot on congressional votes in order to take back the House. It doesn't make a lot of sense, except that it's partially incumbency and it's partially this sort of geographic clustering. Democrats have less margin of victory or error to get those kinds of victories, and I think this same thing is happening in Minnesota. And the Democratic Party needs to either learn how to expand their message and their base back into these rural areas, or they need to think about a different way to approach the problem.
One more thing here from Jeff Blodgett, Brian, before you weigh in. Here's the other thing he said to MinnPost when he noted where Hillary Clinton won in Minnesota in 2016. To me, that's a lesson in really where the votes are. She won with very strong performances in the greater Twin Cities metro area and the suburbs, and a few other pockets, Duluth and St. Louis County.
Yeah, so a factoid on that, Hillary Clinton won only 9 of Minnesota's counties,
which
still won statewide.
Mind-blowing.
And, you know, just it wasn't very long ago that Democrats had much more success in greater Minnesota. You know, there's these pivot counties, which are counties that went twice for President Obama and then voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
There are 206 around the country. In Minnesota, there were 19 of them. That's the third most behind Iowa and Wisconsin, which, you know, maybe we're seeing something here in the upper Midwest.
Yeah.
But in some of these counties in greater Minnesota, Barack Obama won by 20 percentage points, and then Donald Trump won by almost 10 or more. I mean, so it's an amazing it probably speaks to the fact that people aren't adhering to parties as much as they are to issue sets or even personalities.
Larry Jacobs would argue with you about that. He talks about party allegiance being pretty strong. Let me get some calls in here to Becky in East Central Minnesota. Senator Lori, hi. Good to have you on the show.
Hi.
I'm glad you called.
Hi. Well, I'm so glad you're having this show. It's so incredibly important. During the last election, I was really critical of the National Democrats. I felt that they were doing things that were really hurting us out here in rural Minnesota as to understanding the needs, you know, things that, for instance, urban Minnesota can't survive without rural Minnesota, or urban America can't survive without rural America. We're so incredibly important, and our issues should be really expounded on the importance of this, and it's not, you know. And I don't think the National Democrats paid attention to the people who didn't have jobs and didn't have work and weren't paying any attention to helping people feel hope, and you have to feel hope. Now, I should be at work. I own a business in rural Minnesota, and I'm not. I'm sitting out here in my car listening to this because I heard it was coming on, and I have to get back into a meeting. But my business is here in Northern Pine County, and I pay way more for broadband than I should. And the fact is that I'm doing it because I want jobs. Good paying jobs with good health care.
So, Senator, if I might,
rural Minnesota,
what are the top three issues when Democrats are out there campaigning this summer and fall that you want to hear them talking about?
I want to hear them talking about the connection between rural and urban Minnesota and how important rural Minnesota is to urban Minnesota. And I just want to mention Growth and Justice is doing this project called Thriving by Design. It's starting a conversation between urban and rural Minnesotans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to bring us somewhere so we understand our dependence upon one another. And the other thing is that rural Minnesota does so much better when Democrats are in charge because they understand the cost of infrastructure and the affordability and how to pay for it. And so these are really vital things to help rural Minnesota expand. And we need fiber to the home. We have electricity to the home. We have phones to every home. We can get fiber to every home. Satellite and cellular is really good and it helps, but fiber is the only way we can do all of the... Okay, I know it. I just can't.
No,
I should get in. I should
Senator,
get back to
okay,
work,
welcome.
Right?
Really good to have you on the show. I'm glad you called in and heard it. I think I better add some questions about broadband and fiber to my interviews with some of these statewide candidates. I see this pop up, but I had no idea it was such a overriding issue here.
Don't you remember that Mark Dayton ran in 2010 on a border-to-border broadband
pledge? I didn't remember that.
And he's not quite there yet. He's tried, but he's still short of that one.
Michelle says, South Dakota Democrat here. Dems need to do a better job explaining their platform. Republican platform does rural areas no good, but their sound bites are very persuasive. People need to stop voting against their own welfare. Another listener here from South Dakota. Decent people, but my values as a Democrat differed so extremely that I left. Few cultural activities, difficult to expose my children to diversity and those different from us. And adds educational opportunities significantly lacking, like language immersion. Conversation here, if you've just tuned in, with Brian Baxt from NPR, who covers politics for us, and Philip Chen from Beloit College, as we talk about how Democrats appeal, make their case, be as persuasive as they can in an election year to voters in rural parts of America and Minnesota, and how they activate some of these rural Democratic voters. Because as we're looking at numbers here, we're saying if Democrats want to regain power in state capitals and in Congress, they need to find a way to talk to rural voters. Are you a rural Democrat? Are you a rural voter? How do you think the National Democratic Party responds to the issues that you care about? Back to the conversation now with Brian Baxt from NPR and Philip Chen from Beloit College. Some interesting reflections here from women in rural Minnesota. Krista says, rural is an intersectional identity. Too often rural is mistaken for white and male. As a white rural woman, I'm seeing a ton of energy and activism among progressive women and people of color. The DFL needs to distribute power to these contingents. Let me stop there just for a second. Philip, what is Krista right when she says there's Democrats are kind of falling into the same old traps about what it means to be a rural person in America today?
I think she's absolutely right about that. But I think it's less about Democrats falling into it and more about what sort of the general consensus is when you say rural. When we say rural, I think what commonly happens is we think of an archetype. And she's right. The archetype for the phrase rural America often is a white male and often an older white male. And so when we think about and that matches what we know about some of the population demographics of rural areas, but it doesn't capture the entirety of the population. And so she's absolutely right that that's what a lot of people use as shorthand when they say rural America, rural Minnesota. They're talking – they're really thinking about issues that affect white men. Mm. But she's absolutely right that there are – that who lives in rural areas and those who have that rural identity are not necessarily white men, or are very much a mix of races, of class, of gender. And so I think that that's an important point to make, that we need to separate out what we mean when we say rural America, rural Minnesota, from policies that might be driven towards white men or pitched more towards other groups within these areas.
And Brian, here's Mallory, who says, I'm from Zumbrota, now living in Rochester. I've always voted for Democrats, but I'm finding myself drifting from the party. I identify more as a Democratic socialist, and I'm afraid the Dems are too centrist. I mean, this is the big debate that's going on around Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's election, right?
Absolutely. But beyond that, you know, once you win, how do you govern? I mean, and that's what these parties are having to deal with, is the people who are winning a lot of these seats that are propelling them to majorities tend to be more of the kind of true blue or true red folks. Uh-huh. And they have to figure out a way to move them off the ideal positions to something practical. And that's where a lot of the struggle comes in, is that you can get elected on all these grand ideas of what should happen, but then what can you accomplish in the environment?
That's the kind of practicality talk that drives some young idealistic politicians crazy, right? I mean, I think, Philip, we were talking about this with the Tea Party. We see this sometimes at the state legislature.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think Brian makes a good point that there's such a difference between how you campaign and how you win office and then how you legislate when you're in there. Part of the reason I think we don't have a true clear test of this, though, from the Tea Party is the persistence of the Hastert rule in the House.
Right.
The idea that you have to have a majority of the majority in order to bring something to the floor.
Because immigration would have passed it but for the Hastert rule, right?
Some version of immigration likely would have passed. I mean, we have a discharge petition in the House, which is a pretty obscure, arcane procedure. Catherine Pearson at the University of Minnesota can tell you far more than I can tell you about this. An archaic, rarely used parliamentary procedure to try to bring a bill directly to the floor on this. And that's really used, in this case, used less to do that, but actually to push the speaker to bring something to the floor. But it's also unclear whether, when push comes to shove, if a moderate immigration bill or moderate for the Republican Party immigration bill came forward and was put to a vote, would the hard right and more moderate Republicans fall in line? It's unclear because of the Hastert rule.
Right.
And there's been a lot of talk as to whether the U.S. Congress is moving more towards a parliamentary system where we have strong party discipline. I think there's evidence that we do see a lot more discipline among the parties. And so part of the reason that we may not have a true test of this yet is because the speaker doesn't like to put those votes or put those members into those kinds of positions. But it's unclear exactly what would happen were the speaker to say, we're going to put this out here, this is what we're voting on, fall in line, that's what you need to do.
Just for listeners, again, who that description went by, the Hastert rule, it is a requirement that brought into effect by Denny Hastert, a former Speaker of the House, that the majority right now, the Republicans in the House have the majority, and that when a bill comes up, the majority of that majority right now, Republicans, support it, are willing to vote to pass it, not getting legislation passed with Democrats. Philip, do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you can have bills that pass with under the Hastert rule that have Democratic support.
Right.
But the idea, of course, is that you don't say rely on the opposition party in order to in order to pass a bill. And you know, as we've seen the Hastert rule evolve, it's actually become even stricter. It's even a bare majority of the party in power is not really enough for the speaker to bring something to the floor.
You know, but Brian, what I find interesting about that is if you talk to voters, now this is what they'll say. We want more bipartisan. This is exactly mm-hmm. what we want.
Retire to the gridlock.
Yeah, right. Get rid of that Hastert role. But that's not the way they vote, Brian. I mean, here and in many other places.
Well, that's not a way. That's not the way a lot of them vote. The fact of it is, a lot of the people who get these names on the get the people on the ballot or get them through primaries are the ones who are more devoted to their causes and they're more purists. And the problem is that these other folks who are worried about the gridlock aren't involved as much through the process, and so they're left with what they're left with.
They're not there at the conventions, at the caucuses, right?
A lot of them aren't.
Call here from Jessica in Foley, Minnesota. Jessica, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
What's your story on this?
My story? Well, my story is that I am a rural Democrat, and I am involved in the DFL party, but I'm not endorsed this year, and I am running for office in 15B.
Yeah, exciting.
but what that really means is I'm spending a lot of time talking to people because I don't have the data that a party endorsement will give you. I'm knocking on every door. And the conversations we're having at those doors are really about money. They're really about economics. They're about jobs, not just for the voters, but for their children, and seeing economic prosperity in the future for their area. And then the caller earlier really was spot on when she was talking about broadband. There's a lot of really good paying jobs that are available to individuals remotely, but they're not if you don't have good internet. So we need to be talking about infrastructure that way in rural America because it does impact the way that we can even interact with our employers. It really interacts our ability to get media. And so I wanted to talk about that as well.
Yeah, it's Jessica, can I ask how old you are?
Sure, I'm 36.
Is this the first time you've run for public office?
It sure is.
Okay. Brian, I think, has a question or a comment.
Well, first of all, I want to commend you for knocking on every door because in some ways these campaigns have become too sophisticated and that the parties and the candidates know too much about every voter, so they're skipping to the ones who are likely to be more receptive to their idea. But also to the points that she's making about the issue set, we don't hear a lot about kind of depth in these campaigns. You know, you don't hear when you're talking about healthcare and access to healthcare, you know, is it a matter of expanding to everybody or expanding public programs or I mean that gets lost in the conversation. Just yesterday at the Paul Ryan, Jason Lewis thing, it was interesting. They were talking about education and how there's a need for skilled workers, and so they're trying to change these vocational education laws to make it so people who want to go that track have an easier time to do it, and there's not the stigma that everyone has to have a 4-year degree.
Right.
And I think that is geared a lot toward some of these areas outside of kind of the urban centers where, you know, it's a much more business oriented or liberal arts oriented track.
Jessica, quick question if you're still there.
Yep.
I'm curious about whether you are finding voters your own age, you know, in their late 20s and 30s, who are engaged in this election year.
Sure. I would say that most people my age are pretty focused on raising their families. And as a mom of three, I feel that, you know, I mean, it's easy to go to sleep politically. So I would say that's not the age group that I'm seeing engaged in rural areas. It's actually that probably 55 to 65 range or newly retired women.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that I'm seeing are the most politically engaged.
Okay. Hey, I wish you luck with this. It's an excellent endeavor to get it out there and run for political office, no matter what party you're representing. Let me grab a call here from Brent in Big Stone County. Hi, Brent. Sounds like you're in politics, yes?
I'm a county commissioner for a dozen years or so.
What are you thinking about the discussion?
Well, it's fascinating. I don't call into things like this very often, but my concern is when we talk rural campaigning, it's a lot more nuanced than I feel the campaigns reach. I mean, it's not the same issue for everyone. There's a tremendous amount of economic inequality out here. And in my 12 years as a commissioner, I've very seldom seen where St. Paul has a better idea of how to fix our problems than we do.
So are you saying there's too much power concentrated in the state capital?
That would be my opinion. I mean, yes.
And just to point out, the county commissioners run without party designation.
Yeah, right.
I was wondering, does that give you the luxury of kind of keeping it on kind of solution-oriented discussions as opposed to letting it drift into the political conversations?
Does that happen,
Brent? It's a tremendous advantage. I'm probably the most liberal guy on our board, and we have another guy who is considerably more conservative than I, and we get along really well because there's things we have to accomplish at the end of the day, and so you have to come up with solutions.
Brent, I'm really glad you called, especially since you usually don't. Thanks for listening and getting your perspective in this. Philip, I wanted to ask you whether you think the key for Democrats is to flip more rural, moderate Republicans, or is it to turn out some of these Democrats that our young woman who is running for office is, you know, is encountering? Young people out in some of these rural areas who are sitting out the elections, or is the battle for Democrats, is it really activating people in the fringe of the cities and in the suburbs? Is that where they're going to get the most traction?
So I'll disagree with Brian on this one, and I will fall on the Larry Jacobs side on this one,
okay.
Which is I think partisanship remains just an incredibly strong motivator. And so flipping moderate Republicans to the Democratic Party is statistically unlikely,
okay,
given what we know about how voting patterns work. They did not change very much in 2016 from the last, 30, 40 years. People who identify as strong Republicans or strong Democrats vote, 80 to 90% for Democratic candidates. And that moves all the way down until we get to that very small slice of the electorate who are true independents, which is, 10, 12, 15%. Everyone else falls into the kind of this more traditional sort of partisan idea. And we see this consistently. Yes, we see more crossover voting at lower level elections. That's how you get the incumbency advantage and things like that. But for the most part, I think it is about, like you said, turnout, getting people who have traditionally identified with the DFL to go out and vote, people who haven't really identified or haven't really been engaged. It's about enthusiasm. And I think in the same sense that 2016 maybe saw what we call an enthusiasm gap favoring Republicans, we have some evidence that same enthusiasm gap is now favoring Democrats in at least the congressional elections, that the Democrats seem more excited about turning out in primaries, getting candidates out there, and it's reflected in some of the generic ballot polls, some of the polling that we've seen, which is why, of course, we're seeing this idea that the Democrats are maybe more likely than not to take back the House.
So to that point, Carrie, more factoids here. Did you know that Mitt Romney and Donald Trump got roughly the same percentage of the Minnesota vote in their presidential runs, about 44.9% of the vote? The difference is Mitt Romney lost by a good 9 percentage points because Barack Obama had far more votes than Hillary Clinton pulled in her election. So there was this enthusiasm
gap.
Running up the total.
Right?
So the votes are out there.
Right.
It's just a matter of getting those folks energized and to the polls. And in midterm elections, that's been a big problem for Democrats in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They've seen a huge drop off, and that's been one of their Achilles heels. And they've typically lost ground in midterm elections.
Not to pile on Hillary Clinton here, but I was reading something that she said in a speech in India. It got a little bit of attention, and it goes to what we're talking about. She said, if you look at the map of the United States, there is all that red in the middle, places where Trump won. What that map doesn't show you is that I won the places that won 2/3 of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. Philip, I know if you are some of the people that are tweeting in today from rural Minnesota and you hear that, you think the Democrats don't get it. We're out here.
Yeah, you know, I would say I think that Hillary Clinton faced a number of structural issues. I don't think we can downplay the role of sexism in this election. But she's also always faced kind of this what she's saying, her the way she says things doesn't always come off, I think, the way she intends them to come off.
Absolutely.
But this, I think what she's trying to say here, I think, is that it is valuing the importance of diversity and the importance of a diverse economy. But I think much like the caller, and I'm going to blank on her name, who was talking about – oh, I guess it was the Twitter – the tweet about intersectionality. But this is – it's missing the point of much of what the sort of idea of rural consciousness or the rural identity is. And it's playing into a strategy that has been used consistently by – since Reagan, really, that ties a distrust of government or a distrust or a dislike of government to a preference for small government. Those don't have to be tied together. And you hear it in Jessica's comments and Senator Lori's comments that government can that if you can separate out the government isn't doing what it needs to do. I'm not trustful of them, but government has a role. That's, I think, where you start to see you can start to sever this link that Kathy Kramer talks about between distrust of government and a preference for small government.
Here's John Nichols from The Nation, a guy who came up in Wisconsin there, Philip. And I think this is interesting. He wrote this last summer about why Democrats don't seem to understand this rural issue. Mm-hmm. Democratic leaders get lost in reveries about reconnecting with the rural white working class, forgetting that 25% of African Americans live in small cities, towns, and rural counties. And then he adds that many Asian Americans live in rural America, and mm-hmm. Hispanic populations are growing in rural counties. Philip, why do they continue to miss this?
I really think that what it is that the Democratic Party in large part is becoming a non-white party if you look at a lot of the levels of support. But it's true that when you think about – again, it comes back to that, what the identity is. What do we think of when we say rural America, and we think of white and often white men? That's problematic. I think it's a hard – sort of cognitive hurdle to overcome. Why do the Democrats keep missing the fact that that rural areas are significantly more diverse? I'm not sure I have a great answer for that, other than to say I think that's right, that that rural areas are significantly more diverse than the public consciousness believes it to be.
Philip, I'm so glad that we can call on you now in Beloit. Thank you so much for being on
Anytime.
The show. Really great to have you. So, Brian, we've talked about the first district. What are some of the other races that you think what we've discussed all hour is going to be at the core of what happens?
Well, I mean, in Minnesota, we have four, maybe five competitive congressional district races this year, which is amazing considering kind of the maps are usually pretty small nationwide.
Yeah.
You know, of course, the 8th district's an open seat. That will be an interesting race just because the Republicans have found kind of their Dan Feehan-style candidate, someone who fits that district quite
well. Isn't this
well.
Question going to – I mean, this is going to come up in the 8th district,
it's going to come up.
Right?
I mean, and the Democrats don't know who their nominee is going to be, and they won't know that for five more weeks. In the 7th district, you know, nobody's really talking about Colin Peterson. He's the guy who represents the district that – a Democrat who – represents a district that Trump won by the most. He was trailed.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Trump won with 61% of the vote in the district, and Peterson also won 52%. So who knows how this shapes out, but the trade issue is really going to play big mm-hmm. out there. I think, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of farmers who are concerned about the impacts of the tariffs. And so that could blunt what otherwise might be an opportunity for Republicans out there. And of course, in the 2nd and 3rd, those are districts where the president hasn't been as strong and the resistance to the president is quite strong. And so those two could could flip as well.
Brian, really good to have you here. Thanks much. Hey, and to let you know here, while we're talking about statewide politics, we've got one-on-one interviews planned over the next few weeks with candidates for governor, both Republican and DFLers. How we do this, the candidate comes into the studio, I'll open up the phone lines, you can call in and ask them questions, and of course, I'll have some questions, too. And you can bet that this issue of broadband is going to be part of that conversation. So I hope you'll tune in.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.